Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
It would be my guess that if you have lived in Hamilton for any period of time, at one time or another, you have set foot in Theatre Aquarius for some kind of show. It is one of the centerpieces of our artistic community. A lot of great, great shows have been carried out there and performed over the years. However, something a little different is going to be happening there now. It's a new idea that's going to allow Canadian shows, and my next guest will explain this better than I am, but Canadian developed shows, musicals, like Come From Away, for example, let's take that one, to be sort of incubated here and tested and worked on and then built and sent out to try and develop Canadian theater and Canadian musical theater, I think, in particular, in a way that it hasn't before. Kelly Strawn is the executive director of Theatre Aquarius. She joins us now. Kelly, thanks for this today.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me.
This is such a cool idea that I've got to believe that it must exist somewhere else in the world as well. Or is this a brand new, out-of-the-blue idea that you guys have all come up with?
Well, I think there are theaters and theater companies that obviously have developed a musical here and there, you know, as they've been working on new plays and as they've been working to get new shows on their stages. But a specific program that, you know, is to the size and scale that we're doing it. I mean, this is literally a $2 million program. We have the producer of Come From Away, Michael Rubinoff, who is one of the co-chairs of our advisory committee. We have Lily Ling, who is also a Canadian composer, but working on Broadway in the musical Hamilton. We have another Canadian, Sean Mays, who is on Broadway right now, also a conductor, who's working with us in the program. So it's really about the kind of size and scope of it that we haven't seen across the country. So it's really exciting that it's coming to Hamilton.
Explain how this works then. Is the idea here that a bunch of creative people are going to get together and essentially, you know, recreate the scene from Get Back, that Beatles documentary where they all get around and start playing and something pops out? Or is it more of an idea that someone's going to come here with a finished idea and it will be worked on? What exactly is going to happen to create this stuff?
Well, it's about incubating works at any stage in development. So each year we're going to pick 2 to 4 projects. So this can be, you know, composers and book writers and lyricists that say, you know what, we need to get in a room, we need a piano, and we just need to, you know, work out some ideas. And this goes all the way to people that have had workshop productions. Maybe they've been in a fringe festival. Maybe they've had, you know, this work shown in front of an audience. But what they need is that next stage. And so, you know, when they come to us, they're actually looking to have a workshop production with an orchestra. You know, it can be sort of, you know, as big as it needs to be. And I think that's the piece that's really important, is that, you know, we wanted enough funding so that people can come to us and say, we have this 20-person musical, can we work on it in your space? And that we'd be able to say yes, because, you know, especially post-pandemic, especially, you know, with the economy the way it is really hard for theaters to say yes to big productions, regardless of whether they're musicals or not. And so we really wanted, you know, to allow people to, like, do whatever, like, make those dreams come true, have a big production, work on a big production, and we won't stop you. We'll really support you. So I think, you know, it really runs the gamut from small, tiny projects to really big projects.
And is there a benefit to Hamiltonians here beyond just that it's being done here? Will these things, once they're worked on, is Theatre Aquarius going to be the place where they are performed first and exposed so that audiences here could see them first?
I mean, it could be. So, you know, Maggie's a great example. We just had the world premiere of Maggie. It opened in Hamilton. It's now on to the Charlottetown Festival. Then it will go on to the Savoy Theater in Nova Scotia. But it premiered here. And I think it was really exciting for Hamilton audience to say, wow, I can say I saw it first. I saw it when. And we're really hoping this project, you know, will end up in the West End. And so that's the excitement that we're bringing, is that, yes, they could see it on our stages. It could also be that they get to see the first workshop production, and that eventually it would go on to Broadway or it would go on somewhere else. And they would say, I saw the very first workshop production of that show. And a workshop production is when sometimes it's just with music stands. They're singing at music stands. And sometimes it's actually fully staged in a rehearsal hall so that the directors and choreographers can kind of work out some of the kinks. And it's exciting to see something at that stage. You can sense in the room when it's something special and that you can always look back and say, wow, I saw the very first iteration of that and there it is on Broadway.
Well, and I have to believe also that when you do that, if it becomes known, you know, if a few of these hit and a few of these become, you know, Come From Away, as I led with, is a perfect example. If a few of these become like that, it would become one of those things where people are clamoring to say, I want to be there to see that first, because who knows if it's the next Come From Away and I want to say I saw it first.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think that, you know, what was so exciting about Maggie being here and working with the producer of Come From Away was what we saw from Hamiltonians. They came to see the show and they really understood what that excitement is all about. And so now, you know, seeing, I mean, Maggie was sold out. You couldn't get a seat. And it sort of proved to us that this is the right place, the right time, that Hamilton's ready for this, that, you know, Theater Aquarius is the right theater, because we just felt so supported. And the feedback we've been hearing consistently since that show closed, we thought, wow, this is it. This is the right place. So yeah, we're really happy that it's happening here.
Just before I let you go, we have had success stories in musical theater from Hamilton. Cassie Levy has been a huge hit on Broadway and Frozen, yep, and a bunch of other things. And Nick Cordero, unfortunately, we know what happened with Nick with COVID, but before then, mm-hmm, huge hit. Is part of the idea here, too, that it will open opportunities for local performers to be part of this to then leapfrog onto those stages?
That's exactly it. And that's really important to the artistic director, Mary Frances Moore, that, you know, we are definitely, you know, sourcing that local talent. There is so much local talent in Hamilton, and even, you know, people that started here and have moved away and, as you say, are on Broadway, or people who are living in Hamilton right now. So it makes sense for us to use the talent that is in the city. You know, we don't have to go far to find the right people to sing the music, to act in the shows. Like, it's all here in Hamilton.
It is. The program is going to be called the National Center for New Musicals, and it's going to be at Theater Aquarius, and it's a very cool thing. Kelly Strawn, I know you have to run. I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk today. Thanks for doing this.
Well, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
I hope that you remember, and you will remember, if the reason I say I hope, because you will remember if you participated, that we had a municipal election back in October. I hope you remember that, because, again, that probably means you voted. We want you to vote in municipal elections. Not everybody does. In fact, a minority, a strong minority, a small minority, relatively speaking, votes in municipal elections. That's got to change. But after this last municipal election, there was an audit done by the city auditor about some of the things that happened and maybe things we could improve upon or draw more people into the process, all those kinds of things. Charles Brown is the city auditor's name, who joins us now, who came up with this report. Thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
This is, before we get into some of the suggestions and some of the other things, I don't know that King Solomon could come up with a way to get people to vote in a municipal election. You're taking a stab at some of this, but why do you think, and I know this is not your area of expertise, but it ties into some of the things that you were tasked with looking at. Why do you think municipal elections are such a tough sell for some people?
Right. You're right. We weren't necessarily tasked directly with figuring out, you know, the solution to this problem. But I think what the work that we did factors into it, because we were looking for an electoral process that would be more effective and,
right,
more efficient, thereby improve, be more convenient, for example, and use more innovative methods of delivery and so forth. So that was part of it, and part of the reason is to get the voter turnout up. This time around, the voter turnout was 35.38%, which was, in fact, you know, better than some other municipalities.
Yeah. And better than we've had for a few years, too, as I recall.
Well, actually, I was looking at that. It was better than last time, I believe. But a few years ago, we were up at around 38.
Okay.
And I think we had one year that was around 40, if I remember correctly. So it does vary. I think the worst year that we've seen is 34%. So we're slightly But this is a phenomenon that's going on with all elections, even provincial elections, right? And so it's somewhat concerning because, you know, the cornerstone of democracy is getting the vote out.
Charles, do we do
a voice.
Do you do or do we, does the city do an audit after every municipal election, or was this unusually requested?
No, this was not the normal case. We don't do an audit of. I think what instigated it was some of the issues that were experienced on election day, with the, for example, the late poll openings and the technology issues that not only the city of Hamilton experienced, but other municipalities as well.
So when you start going through this, was there any evidence, and again, I don't know if this is what you were looking for, was there any evidence that those things suppressed the vote or deterred the vote or really had any impact on what happened with the election?
Well, we did do a survey, and some of the feedback we got indicates came from people that didn't vote. So the natural question is, why didn't you vote? And there was a whole host of reasons that have to do with, you know, I don't know the candidates, I don't know this, or I didn't have time, or whatever. You might put that in sort of the category of just not wanting to vote or just being apathetic.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another category in there, and quite a large one. I think it's 19% was due to mobility issues.
Oh,
so that in fact might give us some clues about how we might want to deliver our election next time around.
I know, and I'm going by memory here, but we did have vote by mail, and I remember hearing council talk about how we're going to make sure that vote by mail becomes more accessible. Is that still a difficult thing to make happen, or was that just something that wasn't executed properly, or was that fine? It was something else.
Vote by mail did this time around. It was the first time we had used it, and it did experience some issues, mostly due to logistics. And hopefully we can learn some lessons. We go into quite some detail in our report about some of the lessons that need to be learned in improving on the vote by mail. It still didn't get the traction that other methods. It came in around 1.7% of votes cast were cast by that method. Roughly 76% were on election day at polls, you know, in-person balloting, and 22% were in-person at advance polls. So there's still a ways to go to make vote-by-mail popular. But one of the other things that's useful about the vote-by-mail is that you get a package, and that one of the reasons for doing it this time around, because of the experience that we have with COVID and not knowing, there might have been, for example, some long-term care facilities, institutions that you wouldn't be able to go in there and do the traditional kind of voting. The vote by mail packages were an option that gave us gave the city the ability to have the PSWs that work in those environments help their residents vote using those kits. So it's got a ways to go to get some traction with the general public. And obviously there are some issues to iron out in terms of the delivery of vote by mail.
You mentioned mobility. I'm interpreting that a large chunk of that would be seniors. That's just a guess, but whatever. Are there rules with polling stations? Could the city go to have somebody designated or a couple people designated to go to a senior's home as advance polls and just be there for a couple hours and then go to the next senior's home? In other words, could you have a mobile voting operation for some of these seniors' homes?
Well, there are arrangements made at various institutions for that very reason. And also, this time around is not something we've tried, but other municipalities have done. There's a vote-in-home option. So that's where we haven't done it in Hamilton, but, for example, I think they do it in Ottawa. And two officials will go to the home because there's obviously a mobility issue, and you apply, and you get this arranged ahead of time to make an appointment. And two officials will come, and you can cast your vote, and it's put into a secrecy ballot, and then they put that, and they seal it all up, and they bring it back to the central polling location, and it's tabulated later.
One of the things that comes up every time, I'm sure this was one of the things that you looked, I know you looked at this, but I'm sure it's one of the things you heard about a lot. We hear every time there's an election now, we got to have online voting. We got to have online voting. This will solve all of our problems. I'm not sure that's the answer, but would online voting solve our problems?
Well, it has a number of risks. We do allude to that in the report. There are a number of risks. One of them is the security issue. You may be aware that several municipalities have used online voting in the past. The smaller ones, not big ones like Toronto or Ottawa, and the province hasn't done it yet. They have they said that they were going to introduce it slowly and by way of by-election to try it out, but they have not yet done it. And part of the reason is there are still many experts that say, despite its advantages, that it's not yet mature enough from a security perspective. The other thing too to consider is that it hasn't in its past implementations. There's really not the conclusive data to demonstrate that this had a significant impact on voter participation. In fact, if you look in our report, we have a chart there where we show a comparison of methods and what the turnout was. And Burlington, for example, is a city that has internet voting, as do four others in our chart, in our report. And all of those municipalities had a lower turnout than the city of Hamilton did. So it's not a panacea, but it could be the right solution for certain people.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating.
Mobility.
Charles, it's fascinating, though, because we hear it constantly. We will get huge turnout if it's convenient. And then when it's convenient, the numbers just don't back it up. I don't know if Brantford was in here. I know Brantford was one of them that had it and not great numbers. It's such an interesting conundrum that it seems like it should make all the sense in the world that would be, as you say, the panacea. But it's not. Now, you do point out one really interesting thing. You have 50 recommendations. I'll let people go, and I don't have time to read them all to them right now. They can go and read them on your report. But number 40, I find really interesting as an idea to try to stimulate voting down the road. It's going to be a long-term thing. Consider implementing a voter in training program for youth. What? Really an interesting idea. How would that work?
So what that is they do this in Ottawa, so they've had experience with it. So youth will go there. You're obviously not eligible to vote, but you can go to the polling station, presumably with your parents or something, and they have it set up so that you can. It's not a real vote, but it's kind of a pretend vote, and you understand you're participating in the process and you're learning about it. So it's kind of an intriguing idea, and we picked that up from comparing ourselves to Ottawa. I thought that would be something that the clerk would want to consider.
Yeah, that's a great idea. And I know that some schools have done something like this where they do it as part of their civics class, where they vote in class and then talk about it after.
Yep.
Whatever. I mean, I like the idea. Whatever it is that can just get the interest, and not just the interest, and Charles, we got to run here, not just the interest, but that makes it part of a habit that you learn as a young kid, that this is what you do when there's an election, you go and you vote. It's just part of what you do. I anything we can do to make that happen is good.
I mean, anecdotally, it seems like you get the higher turnouts when there are significant issues in a particular city.
Of
so
course.
You might see a high turnout in a particular municipality that is experiencing some sort of controversial issues of some sort, and you tend to get higher turnouts. So that's what makes it so difficult to analyze statistically, because you can't just compare one municipality to another, because one municipality you're looking at might be alive with all kinds of controversy versus another.
Well, Charles, all you have to do as auditor or get the city manager to do this is make sure that we have a huge LRT fight breakout right before every election every year, and we're good. And we'll have lots of people because everyone's fighting with each other. And that's Charles Brown. He is the city auditor. You can go read the report. It's online at the city website. You can find it there. Charles, really appreciate the time today. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
The Toronto Maple Leafs have been giving some thought to what they're going to do with their future because, as you know, they, speaking of failed, failed once again. Yeah, they got through a first round of a playoffs, but, you know, after 7 or 8 years, that hardly seems like it's worthy of much celebration. I know it was. I know there was a lot of celebration a few weeks ago, but in retrospect, the bar seems to be set rather low now if that's the high point of almost the past decade. And so anyway, they made a change, and today we learned that Brad Treliving is going to be taking over as the Leafs' new general manager. He is now going to be the man tasked with ending 56 years of frustration and futility and annoyance and failure, all those things that Leaf fans just are on hands and knees praying that before they die, somebody will figure out how to crack the code and make this team a winner. Stephen Ellis is an associate editor with Daily Faceoff who joins us now. Stephen, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am good. So, with all that lead in, is Brad Treliving the man to crack the code and end more than half a century of frustration?
Well, of all the available options that were external, he was probably the best bet. I'm still on the board that they should not have gotten rid of Kyle Dubas. The best GM available on the market right now was the guy that let go. It's a downgrade to me, but it's, you know, it's a guy that's willing to make big moves. He made one last year. It did not work. He lost Tkachuk, and obviously Huberto didn't exactly work out the way he wanted, but we at least know he's willing to make moves, and if that's what it takes, then maybe that's what they need.
Yeah, now, of course, that's Treliving you're talking about when he was in Calgary who traded Tkachuk. Now, that was a really interesting trade because he essentially was trading with both hands tied behind his back and a blindfold on because Tkachuk had essentially said, I'm going to Florida, so trade me there and you see what you can get, but good luck. And I actually thought that Treliving got way more than I would have expected he could have under the circumstances.
For sure. And, like, you know, Mackenzie Weegar is just coming off of being the best defenseman at the World Hockey Championship. And, you know, Huberto dropped almost 70 points, but we don't expect that to happen again. So, you know, if Huberto can go out there, if a new coach, and he can kind of find that, I think he can come close to 100 points again. And with the addition of Weegar on the blue line, you know, that's a group that's going to be very dangerous next year. I have a lot of hope for the Flames. I think for them, they really just needed the coaching change. And then maybe we wouldn't be looking at that trade looking so lopsided right now, but it didn't help that Tkachuk's going to the Stanley Cup final, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, you know, like, that was one heck of a return. You don't see blockbuster moves like that, but that was something where, you know, I think it still could pay off for Calgary. It's still early days.
Okay, let me throw that one at you then, because you mentioned that all they needed was a coaching change. They didn't really need to change the GM. They needed to change the coach. Any chance that that is the situation in Toronto, that if Sheldon Keefe had been the one ushered out instead of Kyle Dubas, that we'd be looking at something more positive?
I think so. But, you know, when you look at the coaching market this year, there's just not a lot of great options available. You look at last year and, you know, guys like Paul Maurice and Dolek there, and there was a lot of good options last year. So if you make a change this year, I don't know if you get a guy that's going to make a huge splash. And you'd have to probably look in the AHL to find someone that would really change things. So, you know, I was surprised if there was one change they needed to make in Toronto, it was getting a new voice in the room. Doesn't look like that's going to be the case, but, you know, changing the GM was not what I would have done. I don't run a hockey team, though, so I guess my opinion doesn't matter, but I'd say, you know, like, if things aren't working on the ice, they can't score goals. And let's be fair, like, you know, the Leafs did actually beat the Panthers, something the Carolina Hurricanes did not do. So not that there's so much silver lining about losing in the second round like that, but, you know, it's clear that teams are having problems dealing with the Florida Panthers right now. So there's that, I guess.
Okay, so Brad Treliving is going to presumably arrive in Toronto. He's probably maybe there now, but he's going to, you know, tomorrow he's having the big introduction, and I guess then, you know, work officially begins after that. And there's a ton of stuff for him to do because he's got a couple players, Austin Matthews and William Nylander, who are needing new contracts, and he's got a coach, whether he wants to keep him or not, and he's got the draft coming up, and he's got this and that. You said you don't run a hockey team. Fair enough. But if you did run this hockey team, what is priority number one for him?
For me right now, the core four has to stay. I don't think you make any changes. Priority number one is making sure you can get Matthews signed to that long-term deal. I don't know what his cap hit's going to be, but it's not going to be as big of a bounce as William Nylander's. And I'm a huge Nylander fan. I think he's a really talented player. I think you could be patient there. You can see how that kind of plays out. And if you do need to make a shake up in the core four, he's probably the guy to do it, because next year he's a free agent and you don't have to worry about that. But for me, I think they need to also shore up the goaltend. And, you know, with Elias Samsonov, you know, very good first season. He's a little bit of a hit or miss goalie throughout his career, but I still think, you know, he's capable of being the number one. So you got to sign him. And then you got to figure out what you're doing with Matt Murray. And I kind of made the joke on Twitter. It's just they got to pull a Garth Snow, and they should have made him the GM. That would solve a lot of issues there. But with Murray, it's, you know, he's healthy, so you can't just put him on Robita Island. You can't just put him on long-term injury reserve without a valid reason. So the thing is, we know he gets hurt a lot. But, you know, the way Joseph Woll played, I think he's ready to be the backup.
Well, so I'll tell you the answer right now, Stephen, is in the first practice of training camp, you tell one of your AHL players, you want to make this team, you accidentally crash into Matt Murray and make sure that he's injured enough, not to hurt his life, just to make sure he can't play so we can put him on the island. Just lose an edge. That's all we need. It's just a whiplash or something that, you know, that he'll recover completely from. That's what you do.
Perfect. And it's too bad because, like, you know, from a personal level, it's like, I want to see him keep playing. You know, he's still young, but it's like, he doesn't make the team better. That's just the reality at this point.
Except he, you know, here's the funny part about that, and I don't want to get too much into the goaltending. For about 3 weeks in January or February or maybe December it was, I don't remember, he was great. He was fantastic. And then all of a sudden it was, you're thinking, oh, maybe this is the answer. And then he was back to his old self. And which is probably exactly what we're going to see from Bobrovsky in Florida. By next fall, they're going to start the new season, and Bobrovsky's going to be a sieve again, as he has been for most of 3 years. But for now, all you needed was for this run, and he's doing that.
Yeah, if Bobrovsky wins the Stanley Cup, it doesn't matter how much they pay him for the rest of his career. He did the job. And, you know, that would be great if that's what Matt Murray could do. But, you know, you look at him in Ottawa, he had some great moments, and he found himself in the AHL. So, you know, it's just like things just happen like that.
All right, so you mentioned, and everybody, anyone who talks about the Leafs talks about the core four, the Nylander, Matthews, Tavares, and Marner group. Riley should probably be in there too, but nonetheless, the forwards. We'll talk about the core four. When you said that they need to keep them together, I do wonder about that, but I also wonder, is there a general manager, especially a new one coming in like Treliving, who is going to have the cojones to move one of those guys with the risk that that guy goes to another team and absolutely lights it up and you end up looking like a goofball?
We know the Toronto Maple Leafs. That tends to happen, right? You know, like Phil Kessel, he leaves, goes and wins two Stanley Cups pretty much immediately. So
Larry Murphy's another one. Yeah, you're
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. It just seems to happen that way. But, you know, with that core four, I think any GM would look at that and say, I want to win with this group. This group has the talent to do it. And, you know, you look at the teams that continue to win the Stanley Cup, and they have these great cores, Colorado, Tampa Bay, these, like, you know, four or five guys who are so important to their team, and then you try to build around that. You know, for all the comments about the core four not scoring in that series against Florida, you know, Matt Tkachuk didn't score a single goal, too. So it was like the Leafs did exactly what they were supposed to do with Florida's core players. Barkov was silent, Reinhart was silent, guys like that. A lot of that comes to making sure your depth can still get the job done. And I think, you know, as much as they got a lot of depth pieces, they weren't scoring either. And I think a lot of the concern was, like, were they doing too many line changes? Were not doing the right line changes? Like, why can't they answer here? A lot of that, you know, like, I would argue they were probably better against Florida than they were against Tampa Bay. Sometimes it just happens that the other team's goalie is a brick wall. But, you know, unfortunately, it's year after year where they keep running into that same situation.
I was just, Stephen, you took the words out of my mouth. You're absolutely right, but it seems as though the Maple Leafs more than other teams. Now, it could be just because around here we see a lot more of the Leafs than other teams. That could absolutely be what I'm talking about. But it seems that during the season, so often the Leafs will play a game and the goalie they're facing has the game of his year. I mean, I don't know how many times it seems, oh, they're bringing in a backup, and then suddenly the guy stops 63 shots, and you go, what the heck? Like, it happens with regularity, and then you see it in the playoffs as well. I don't understand why it happens to the Leafs, if the Leafs excite other teams and other players and gets them motivated, or if the Leafs are doing something wrong. I don't know, but it happens all the time.
It's unfortunately kind of feels like that. We look at, like, against Columbus, a series the Leafs should have won in 2020, and Korpisalo played unbelievable. Or the year after, Carey Price misses an entire month, plays the greatest series he's ever had, leads the team to the cup, and then never plays again. Like, you know, it's I don't know how to explain that. It's goaltending doesn't make a lot of sense in the NHL.
But how come, since Ed Belfour, probably. How come that's never happens for the Leafs since Ed Belfour, now almost 20 years ago?
Well, you know, kind of look at the starting goalie history just in the last couple of years, and you got a lot of guys who struggle to stay healthy at a baseline minimum.
Yeah,
They need their goalie to be the better goalie, and we just haven't seen that.
I know, but again, what we're talking about, and look, I'm not yelling at you. It's that we're talking about teams that face Toronto, and nobody's figure it out. How come the Leafs, who have had some nobodies, can never figure it out the same way? I just don't get it.
If anyone knew the answer, they'd be the GM right now. I'll just say that.
There you go, or the head coach. Listen, it is going to be an announcement tomorrow. Well, we had the announcement today. It's going to be an introduction tomorrow. Just before we let you go, is Brad Treliving a guy who is going to have a long leash, do you think? Not with the Leafs brass. I mean, he's going to have as long a leash as anyone with them. With Leaf fans, because I do think that people are now, I mean, they're always they're always feeling impatient because it's been over a century. But are Leaf fans going to give this guy time to sort this out? Or if they don't go far in next year's playoffs, is Brad Treliving already a bum?
I think I'd be concerned for him just because, you know, you look at the reception when they got rid of Dubas, and it was overwhelmingly like, why? Well, that's the wrong decision. So I think, you know, if the Leafs start next season and they're not on fire, or if they're not looking as good as they could, and they didn't make any major changes in the summer, people are going to start pointing towards them. You know, if they start off poor, which I don't expect, I do think the first person to go will be Sheldon Keefe. And, you know, I think I'd also be worried about Shanahan's future there. But when it comes to the Treliving, I think, you know, they're just such a lukewarm reaction to begin with today. And then you look at the reaction when Dubas was let go. I think, you know, that people won't be as receptive to it.
That is Stephen Ellis. He's an associate editor with the Daily Faceoff. Listen, we always love having you on. Thanks for taking time to do this today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.